far too much to speak of at a meeting. We are challenged by the modern world, and the modern world is modern to every generation, one after the other, at every moment of our life. But there are moments when it is worth reflecting on what a challenge is and what kind of challenge we are facing. Every generation, I think, is faced with change. And change means, for the ones, a degree of bewilderment, because it means that things which were taken for granted in the past, which seem to be so secure, are gradually disintegrating or being questioned, and questioned in a decisive and very often in an aggressive way. For others, change means uncertainty in another way. The younger enter into a world of change and do not know where it will lead. And so both groups, the ones for whom the old world is disintegrating, disappearing, changing out of recognition, and the ones who live in a world that is in the making, but whose shape they cannot understand, they cannot perceive, are equally challenged, but in different ways. And I would like to present you with two or three images and my conclusions, because all one can do with regard to one's own life is to share what one has learned or what one believes to be true. The first image is this, or rather, before I give you the image, we all always expect that the right thing should be, that things should be harmonious, should be peaceful, unproblematic, that life should develop in the way in which a plant grows, from a seed, protected, nursed, into a blade, and gradually into its fulfillment. And yet we know from experience that it is not so. I believe that God is the God of the storm as much as the God of harmony and peace. And the first image that comes to me is the story in the Gospel of Christ walking on the sea in the midst of a storm. The story which presents us with Peter trying to reach him, walking on the waves. What happened there? Of course, leaving aside the historical moment of it, what can it say to us about it? The first thing which I see in it is that the presence of Christ did not still the storm simply because he was there. And that, I think, is important, because very often, when we are caught up in a storm, great or small, we have a tendency to think that if there is a storm, then God isn't there, that something has gone wrong with God, usually, rather than with us. The second thing is that if God can be right in the middle of the storm and not be swayed, broken, destroyed, it means that he is at a point in the storm which is a point of equipoise. And in a hurricane, in a tornado, in any storm, there is a point of equipoise. There, the point at which all the violence of the storm meets, all the conflicting violence meets the eye of the hurricane. And that is where God is to be found. Not at the outskirts, not where things are safe enough for him to walk on dry land while we drown in the sea, but at the point where there can be no worse situation, where all the violence, all the conflict is there. When we think of the story of Peter on the waters, we see that his impulse was right. He found himself in deathly danger on a small skiff that could be drowned, broken to pieces by the waves, upturned by the wind. And he saw the Lord at the heart of the storm in his own wonderful stillness. And he knew that if he only could reach that point, he also would be right in the middle of the storm, yet in a stillness that was beyond imagining. And he proved ready to abandon the safety of the skiff that was a very frail protection against the storm, but still was a protection. The other disciples were safe enough in it, and to move on to the storm. He did not reach the Lord because he remembered that he could drown. He began to think of himself, of the storm, or the fact that he had never walked on the waves. He turned from God to himself, and then he could no longer move Godward. He had lost the security of the skiff, but not found the total security of the place where the Lord is. And I think that when we think of ourselves in the modern world, and as I said before, the modern world is modern from generation to generation. There is no moment when the world is not the same storm, only presenting itself in different guises to different generations. We all are confronted with the same problem. There is a security in the small skiff. There is danger all around. There is the Lord at the heart, at the point of equipoise. And then there is a question. Am I prepared to walk across? This is the first image, and I'm not going to unravel it for you more than I have done. The second image that comes to my mind is that of the act of creation. The act of creation is described in the first line of the Bible, in which we are told that God created the earth and the heavens. Nothing more is said about it. And when we think of it, or rather when I think of it, what I see, what I imagine, is God, plenitude, harmony, beauty, calling by their name all the beings that could exist. Calling, and every one of the beings emerging out of naught, of total, radical absence, in primeval harmony and beauty, and the first thing they see is the ultimate and perfect beauty of God. The first thing they perceive is a total harmony of the Lord. And this harmony is called love. This beauty is called love. A dynamic, creative love, which we express by speaking of the Trinity being the perfect image of a love relationship. But when we think of the next lines, or rather the second half of the same line, we see something which should make us reflect on our condition, because it says that the first call of God created what the Hebrew calls the chaos, the tohu vabohu, a chaos out of which he was calling forms, shapes, realities. The word used in the Bible for the first act of creation that brings about this chaos, and I will try to define it in a moment, and what comes next is not the same. In the first place, the word used is a word that indicates creation, the calling out of naught of what was not there. In the second place, it speaks of fashioning out of existing material, as it were. Now, when we think of chaos, we always think of disorder, of a disorderly being. When we think of chaos in our room, we think of a room that should be orderly and which we have made into a shambles. When we think of chaos wider in life and in the world, we can think of what happens to a city when it is bombed, a society of conflicting interests where love has gone dim or died, and when there is nothing left but greed, self-centeredness, fear, hatred, and so forth. To us, chaos is a situation in which what should be harmonious is no longer harmonious. What should be harmonious is not in order. And our tendency is to put things in order, that is, to give to every chaotic situation an orderly disposition and fix it. To use an image again, for us to resolve the problem of the chaos of a raging sea would to freeze it down so that it becomes immobile. But this is not the way in which God deals with situations. The chaos of which the Bible speaks in the first place, I think, is something different. It is all the potentialities, all the virtual reality which has not yet emerged into shape. We can speak in such terms about the intelligence, the perceptiveness, mind and heart of a child. In that sense, it is still a chaos, in the sense that it is all there, all is possible, nothing has yet unfolded. It is like a bud that contains all the beauty of the flower, but which is still to open up. And if it doesn't open up, nothing will be revealed. The chaos of the primeval chaos of which the Bible speaks, I think, is that immeasurable, unfathomable complex of possibilities that contains all that can be, not only that could be, but all that can be now and the future. A bud that can expand forever. And the act which is described in the Bible as fashioning the world is an act by which God calls out one potentiality after the other, waiting for it to be mature, waiting for it to be ready to be born, and then giving it shape and launching into life and into reality. I think this is an important imagery because the world in which we live still is this kind of chaos. It is a creative chaos. It is a creative chaos which has not yet unfolded to the full. It is a creative chaos which continues to give birth to new and new realities, and each new reality, because it is new, is frightening to the old world. There is a problem of mutual understanding between generations. There is a problem in understanding the world of an epoch if you were born and reared in another one. You may be bewildered by what you see 20 or 30 years after your own maturity has been shaped. You may stand before a world which should be familiar because it is populated by your descendants, your friends, and yet it is a world that has become practically incomprehensible. And again, the tendency which we have is to put it in order. This is what has been done by all dictatorships, which took a world in the making, or a world that had collapsed into disorder, and gave it a shape, but a man-made shape. Because we are afraid of the chaos. We are afraid of the unknown. We are afraid of looking into the dark abyss because we do not know what will emerge out of it and what we can do with it. What will happen to us if a shape comes up, some being comes up, some situations come up which we are no understanding of. And this, I think, is the position in which we are all the time, from generation to generation, and even within our own lives. There are moments when we are afraid of what is happening to us, of what we are becoming ourselves. I do not mean that in the primitive sense in which one may be horrified at the way in which one deteriorates through drink, through drug, through the way in which we live, or through outer conditions, but through what is emerging within us. Things which we had never suspected are there. And again, the easiest way, as it seems to us, is to suppress them, to try to destroy what is emerging and is frightening us. We are afraid of the creative chaos. We are afraid of the potentialities that are gradually emerging. And we try to resolve it by bringing things back or fossilizing them, by stabilizing them, by freezing them down. Those people who are artists may well find a solution by projecting what is going on in them, either in the form of painting, of sculpture, of music, of dramatic performance. But these people are the privileged ones, because an artist will, if he is a true artist, project onto his medium more than he is aware of. He will be able to see himself projected onto canvas or onto sound or line or color or form in a way in which he cannot see himself. It is a revelation of self. This is the principle that allows a psychologist to read a painting which the painter has projected without knowing what it was. I remember one case, I'm no reader of paintings, but I have in my experience one occasion that still surprises me, or rather for which I have got a clue in what an old lady said to me about it. A young man came to me some 30 years ago with a big canvas like this and said to me, I was sent to you because such and such person thinks you can read this canvas for me. I said, why? Well, I am under analysis. My analyst cannot read it, neither can I. But we have a common friend who said, you know, you are a complete crackpot. You must go to someone who is as mad as you are. And she sent him to me. I found it was very gratifying. And so I had a look at the painting, and I saw nothing. So I asked him to leave the painting, and I lived with this painting for 3 or 4 days. And then I began to see something. And after that, every month I went to his place and looked at his paintings and read them for him until he began to read his own paintings freely, as one can read one's own verse or whatever one produces with understanding. That should may happen to all of us at moments of our lives. We may be able to understand what a person is about more than this person at a given moment. We should be able to face our contemporary life exactly in such terms. God is not afraid of chaos. God is at the heart of it, calling out of it reality, and a reality that will unfold with newness, which means in a frightening way, until all things are accomplished. When I said that I believe that God is the Lord of harmony as well as the Lord of the storm, I meant perhaps something more, because the world in which we live is not the primeval chaos pregnant with possibilities which, not yet being unfolded, are loaded with no evil and have not gone wrong, as it were. We live in a world in which what has come into being has been badly distorted. We live in a world of death, of suffering, of evil, of incompleteness, and there is, in the world in which we live, these two faces of the chaos. The primeval source of possibilities, the potential, and also the distorted reality. And this is what makes the problem more difficult, because we cannot be simply contemplative and look at what emerges out of naught or shapes gradually into greater and greater perfection, like a child in the womb that begins by being an embryo but must evolve into the completeness of a human being or of an animal. We are to face also the destruction, the evil, the distortion. And at that point, we have got to play a role, and a very decisive one. One of the problems which I see, nowadays perhaps more than in my youth, and perhaps is it that growing old, one feels that the past is more harmonious and more solid than the present, is that the challenge is not taken up. Most people would like someone else to resolve the challenge. The believers, whenever a challenge or a danger or a tragedy occurs, wish to run to God and say, protect us, I'm in trouble. The political animal will turn to government and say, it is your business to put things right. Other people will turn to philosophies or to action. But one way or another, we are not, I think, aware of the fact that each of us is called to take an active, intelligent part in resolving the problems which are ours. Whatever we think philosophically, we are sent into this world, or placed into this world, and whenever we perceive its disharmony or its ugliness, it is for us to look at it deeply and ask ourselves, what can I contribute to its becoming truly harmonious? Not conveniently harmonious, not simply decent, not only livable. Because there are periods when, before we come to a livable situation, we must go through periods which are not livable at all, in the way in which surgery may be necessary, or in which a clash at times, like a thunderstorm, clears the air. I believe that we are challenged by the present world in two ways. We must look at it instead of trying to avoid seeing. And most of us, we would prefer not to see certain aspects of life, because not seeing frees us from a great deal of responsibility. Not to know that people are hungry, not to know that people are persecuted, not to know that people suffer and die in hospitals is an easy solution. It's a fool's paradise, but we are, to a very great extent, all of us, fools, or we wish to be fools, because it would be so much more convenient, so much more easy to live, if we could forget everything except what is good in my own life. So it requires a great deal more courage than we are prepared to afford most of the time, to look at tragedy, to allow ourselves to receive this tragedy as a wound in our heart, is important. The temptation is to avoid the wound by transforming pain into anger, because pain is, in a way, a passive situation in which it is inflicted on us, received by us, endured by us. Well, anger is a reaction of mine. I can be cross, I can be angry, I can act. Not much. Certainly not to solve the problem, usually, because, as one of the epistles says, the anger of man does not re-establish the rightness meant by God. But it still remains that it is easy to be angry. It is very difficult to be offered to suffering. The ultimate image of this offering I see, for instance, in Christ accepting his passion and his crucifixion as a gift of self. The other thing is that it is not enough to face things, to perceive them, to accept the suffering. We are sent into this world to change it. And when I say change, I think of all ways in which the world can be changed, but least of all by, say, political or social readjustment. The first thing that must happen is a change in us that would allow us to be in harmony, and the harmony that could be projected outward or spread. This, I believe, is more important than any change we can try to effect around us otherwise. When Christ says the kingdom of God is within us, it means that unless we enthrone God within our life, if we have the mind of God and the heart of God and the will of God and the vision of God, all that we will try to make or to create will be disharmonious and incomplete to a certain degree. I do not mean to say that any one of us can achieve this in its fullness, but to whatever degree this is achieved, it spreads around us in terms of harmony, of beauty, of peace, of love, and changes things around us. An act of love, of sacrificial love, does change things, even for people who do not suspect it, do not immediately perceive it. So that we must ask ourselves questions about our own ability to be, to face things with courage. And courage always means the readiness to forget oneself and to look at the situation on the one hand and the need of another on the other hand. As long as we are self-centered, our courage will break down, because we will be afraid for our bodies, for our minds, for our emotions, and we will never be able to risk all, including life and death, into the bargain. It is a question which we must ask ourselves all the time, because we are timid, cowardly, hesitant, day in and day out. We are asked the question and we skirt it and give an approximate answer, because it is easier than give a straight one. We should do something and we think, I'll do that much of it and leave the rest for later, and so forth. And so we must train ourselves to be the people who are sent into this world to bring into it harmony, beauty, truth, love. Moffat, in a translation of the New Testament, says, we are a vanguard of heaven. We are people who must be aware of the divine scale of vision, and who are there to widen, deepen, brighten the scale of vision of all those around us. We are not called to be a society of people who enjoy their mutual acquaintance and are happy to hear one another saying wonderful things and wait for the next occasion to be together again. We are to be taken by the hand of God and sown into the wind and fall wherever we can fall, set roots and bring out a blade. At a risk, our vocation is to take part with others into the building of the city, a city of men, yes, but this city must be coextensive with the city of God. or if you prefer, a city of men that would be so vast, so deep, so holy, that one of its citizens could be Jesus Christ, the Son of God, become man. Anything short of this, smaller than this, is not a city of God or a city of men worthy of men. I'm not even saying of God. It is too small for us. But to do this, we must accept the challenge, face it, face ourselves first, attain to the stillness and harmony which is needed, and either act from within this harmony or shine out the light, because we are called to be the light of the world. No, I don't think it's too late, because for one thing, to say that anything is too late is to condemn oneself to being inactive, to give way, and to add to the rot. And for another thing, the world is remarkably young. I'm not speaking of chimpanzees and dinosaurs, but speaking of humans, we are a very young race. We are really newcomers. We have done a lot of damage in the short time we have been here. But we are very young, all in all. And as I can see, you know, I'm not a historian, but the little I know is that the world has gone continuously up and down through crises, through dark periods and light periods. And people of one generation most of the time feel that when things had become, have gone back into a chaotic situation, it must be the end. Well, experience has told, should have told us, that every time there is a re-emergence of some sort. And I do believe that, well, there is still time. I'm no prophet in that respect, but I think until I'm dead, I'll fight. When I die, it will no longer be my responsibility. But I'm not going just to sit back and say I can't understand the world now. I will continue to say what I believe to be true, to try to share what I believe to be beautiful, and whatever the result is not my business. I do believe that there will be a moment of dramatic collapse of all things, but I think we are not yet there. I remember during the Russian Revolution, at the period when contradictory meetings were allowed, someone asked from a Christian preacher, a Baptist, whether he thought that Lenin was the Antichrist. And he answered, no, he's far too small for that. And I think that when I look around, I think that everyone whom certain people call the embodiment of evil are far too small for that kind of imagery. I think we are not yet ready for ultimate tragedy. Well, obviously, atom bombs and nuclear weapons and so on have introduced a dimension quantitatively, a dimension which wasn't there before. Ill will or accident are there. But I can't remember who said that what is decisive is not the fact that there are or are not nuclear weapons. What is decisive is whether a person or a group of people will be prepared to use them. And I think that is the important thing which I feel about it. peace, security, and so on, are things that must begin within us and within our midst. We could stop the existence of all nuclear weapons and still wage a war of destruction and destroy one another to perfection. One can destroy life on Earth without any nuclear weapons. One can create hunger that will destroy millions of people. One can kill with what one calls abnormal weapons to an extent and the degree that could depopulate the planet. So the problem is in us and not in the weapon itself. You know, in the early centuries, St. John Cassian, speaking of good, evil, and evil, said, there are a few things which are good, a few things that which are evil, but most of them are neutral. And he said, take a knife. It is completely neutral in itself. The only problem is who has got this knife and how this knife will be used. And here, there is a point in us, human beings, treating the world in which we live with reverence, with respect, treating one another with respect. But it is not the presence of one form of destruction that the other. It's the fear, the hatred, the greed within us that can do things. Now, I don't think that I'm entitled to give an answer in any direction with any kind of authority. I remember a French novel in which a character was expressing his views with great energy, and his interlocutor said, you say my opinion as this carpet could say my place, and that is really all I can do. I think that what you say about the nuclear energy was probably felt and said at different epochs about other things. When gunpowder was invented, it was in a way as terrifying for the people of that moment as nuclear energy is for us. And you know, I may be an extraordinarily insensitive creature, but when I was 15 or so, I read with great passion the Stoics. And I remember reading in Epictetus a passage in which he said, there are two kinds of things, the things you can do something about and those you can do nothing about. Those you can do something about, do something about. The other ones, forget about and leave them alone. And I may be like an ostrich that hides its head in the sand, but I simply live day in and day out without ever thinking of the fact that this world can be destroyed by nuclear energy, or that I can be run over by a car, or that a burglar can come into the church. And what matters to me is really the mind of people who will or not act in one way or another. That is something which is within our reach, which can be done. To help people understand that compassion, that love matter is one thing. What worries me about so much of the peace campaigning is that most of it is based on telling people, do you see how frightening it is? It's not because it is frightening. That is irrelevant. What is relevant is that it is loveless. It's not cowardice that should make us peacemakers. It is an other attitude to our neighbor. But then, if that is true, it doesn't begin a power station. It begins at home, it begins in the street, it begins in all sorts of places. I remember during the war, in the very, very beginning, I came back from the army and there was a raid on Paris, and I went into a shelter. And there was a woman there who was speaking with great energy about the horrors of war. And she said, "Can one imagine in our time that monsters like Hitler could exist? People who don't love their neighbor. If I had him, I would put pins in his body until he dies." Well, I feel that a lot of that is still there. If one could destroy the evildoer, but the moment you destroy the evildoer, you have done something as destructive, because it's not quantity, it's what you have done that counts. You know, there is another thing, a story from a French novel. I don't think I'm so naive as to think that it is only subjective and a failure of faith. I think there is something frightening in everything that can destroy human bodies.